there again, and welcome to another episode of Musings on Golf, where today you'll hear terrific stories from one of the newest members of the World Golf Hall of Fame, Padraig Harrington. We'll also put a bow on two terrific Olympic golf events, look back on one of the craziest finishes to a PGA Tour event ever, and we'll look ahead to the start of the FedEx Cup playoffs. Finally, we'll pay tribute to one of our game's greatest characters, Chichi Rodriguez. My name is Kelly Elbin, and along with my co-host, Bob Bupka. Bob, you know, I know our listeners will really enjoy hearing from Padraig, and I also know how much Chichi, himself a World Golf Hall of Famer, meant to so many of us. Bob, Chichi's going to really be missed.
Well, you're right about that, Kelly. Chichi was one of a kind. He was ahead of his time with that sword that he would put in after making a putt. He was a crowd delight. Back then, you know, players just played. They didn't entertain. I'd have to rate Chichi Rodriguez as one of the first entertainers while playing golf. And I knew him personally. He was always kind to me. We had a lot of good times together. I remember once meeting him at the merchandise show, and we just bumped into one another and spent about an hour together laughing and joking and telling stories. That's the type of guy he was. Chichi Rodriguez, he'll be long remembered, certainly one of the main characters that ever played on the PGA Tour.
Yeah, and that sword dance, heck, Bob, I know a lot of people who just have fun doing that on their own, playing a weekend round of golf. And that legacy, it carries on. Bob, he won 8 times on the PGA Tour, first Puerto Rican to be inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame. He won the Bob Jones Award in 1989 from the United States Golf Association. That's the USGA's highest honor. And Bob, in large part, he won that because of his philanthropy. Years and years, the Chichi Rodriguez Youth Foundation in Clearwater, Florida. They've helped at-risk youth achieve academic, social, economic success. And this from a guy, Bob, who grew up dirt poor, took a branch off a guava tree and taught himself the game. Talk about someone who appreciated the opportunities to which he gave and through the foundation continues to give to so many kids in need.
Yeah, very well said there, Kelly, because a lot of people know about the exploits on the golf course of Chichi Rodriguez, but here part of our mandate on Musings on Golf is to tell the rest of the story, and the rest of the story with Chichi, as you perfectly said, Kelly, so generous off the golf course and helping so many without, because he came from without.
Yeah, it's true. Our listeners are absolutely going to enjoy hearing from Padraig Harrington. You talk about a guy whose story itself is fascinating. Before we get to that, let's take a quick look. I cannot, honest to goodness, remember a crazier ending to a PGA Tour event over the last, handful of holes than what happened at the Wyndham Championship in Greensboro over the weekend. You had Max Greisserman looking for that first win on tour. What does the guy do? He holds out for eagle on 13. Then he drives it out of bounds, makes quadruple bogey 8 on 14. Then birdies 15, and then 4 putts for double bogey on 16, opening the opportunity for Aaron Rye. Bob, the Englishman has played really well. He closed with 64. He deserved to win it. Of course, the event didn't actually end on Sunday with all that rain because Matt Kuchar made an odd decision, but a financial one, to come back on Monday. What an unusual way to wrap up the final event on the PGA Tour leading into the FedEx Cup playoffs.
Yeah, Kelly, except for one thing. You know, you described it as an odd event. It was unique in that we haven't seen it happen. But Matt Kuchar was well within the rules, because the rules clearly stipulate if a player deems himself it's too dark to play, he can suspend play, and that's what Matt Kuchar did. Now, would it have been better for the PGA Tour and for television and everything else had he not done that? I agree. Probably Matt Kuchar didn't even think of all the ramifications when he made that decision, but he didn't commit any rules violations. As a matter of fact, he operated well within the rules, It just was strange that we would get to see an event like that on the PGA Tour.
When I first, I didn't see all of it on Sunday night, went into primetime. I didn't see the very end. When I first read about it, I was kind of caught off guard. The more I looked into it, the more I tend to agree with you, Bob. In fact, you know, even though he didn't make the top 70 in FedEx Cup, and that ends, he was the only guy, only active player to have played in every FedEx Cup playoff since 2007, since it was started. But he finished outside that. But that putt, that what he made, par on the last hole, whatever he made, he ended up 103rd on the FedEx list. Now the top 125 through the fall events. Keep their cards for 2025. I don't blame Kuchar. He had a lousy drive off the tee on 18. He didn't even realize Aaron Rye was out in the fairway. That was strange. But in hindsight, he did the right thing, Bob.
Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, I've known Matt Kuchar. I've known his father, Peter, very well. Somebody'd have to be hard-pressed to convince me that Matt Kuchar would do something deliberately wrong. I, for one, stand for him. Did it look right? Probably not. But he was well within the rules. And way to go, Matt Kuchar.
And way to go, Aaron Rye. The Englishman has played well, Bob. He's had a lot of excellent finishes on the PGA Tour. He's known for wearing the two black gloves. He has the covers on all of his irons. And kind of a really special story about how much golf has meant to him based on how he grew up in England. Let's hear from Aaron Rye in terms of what the PGA Tour meant to him growing up and then this victory.
And after turning professional, I played a lot in Europe and my focus was largely in Europe. And again, the PGA Tour wasn't really on my radar. Luckily, it kind of happened when maybe I was ready for it to happen. And then, yeah, being out here, I really appreciate how strong of a tour it is, how great of a tour it is. And just how high the level of golf is. So all the memories as a kid and growing up in my teens mixed with actually understanding the reality of what the tour is like just makes it that little bit more special. Being a PGA Tour winner is truly a dream come true. To win on any professional golf tour is an incredible accomplishment. The PGA Tour is the pinnacle of golf, and it's amazing to be competing here week in, week out. But to have won a tournament is extremely special and something I'll always remember.
So refreshing to hear somebody, Kelly, really appreciate what he accomplished. He fully understands that, you know, to win on any tour, he was so right in saying it's an accomplishment. To win on the PGA Tour, the best of all the tours, it really is an accomplishment. Congratulations on a job well done, and he'll be somebody we'll have to keep an eye on, qualified now for the next 2 years.
Yeah, and he's also qualified for next week among the top 70 to play at TPC Southwind in Memphis at the FedEx St. Jude Championship. That's the first event on the FedEx Cup playoffs, and then you have the top 50 from that event advance to the BMW Championship, which goes back to a tournament coming back to Castle Pines outside of Denver, Bob, where they used to play the modified Stableford. That will be the second FedEx Cup event. They won't play the modified Stableford, but what a wonderful golf course and venue that's been off the map for the PGA Tour for far too long. Great to have it back.
Yeah, Jack Nicklaus designed, and I had the opportunity to play it many times. Matter of fact, I remember once on a Wednesday, I pulled up to the media center and media director said, "You want to play in the Pro-Am?" And I said, "Heck yeah." He said, "Well, go grab your club." So I get my clubs. They throw them on a court. I'm driving out there. I said, "Who am I playing with?" They said, "Stephen Ames." And Stephen Ames was the one that had all that problems with Tiger earlier in the week. And
That's right.
Yeah, he wasn't known as, the most pleasant guy out there, even though once you got to know him, certainly was solid. But anyway, with a shotgun start, we get to a par 3 elevated pond down below. The first two amateurs hit, and they both put it in the pond. Steve gives me that look like, "All right, Bubka, you've been BSing about golf for a long time. Let's see you deliver." So he's trying to help me, but he was intimidating me. And I said, "Don't worry, Stephen Ames. I got the club for this one." And I reach into my bag and take the head cover off. Uh-oh. There was saran wrap, bubble wrap still on that club. I had never hit it. And took the bubble wrap off, knocked it on the green. Stephen Ames thought a lot more of me from that point on because I was able to pull off a shot that I had never even tried before.
Took off the old bubble wrap and got it done, huh?
Got it done with the bubble wrap.
I'll tell you who also got it done. Congratulations to Lydia Ko. Two great weeks of golf at the Olympics outside of Paris with Scheffler's dramatic win for the men. And then Lydia Ko, not only winning the women's Olympic competition, but thereby earning herself getting into the World Golf Hall of Fame. What an accomplishment for a terrific player who's been a great one on the LPGA Tour for a very long time and has a long future ahead of her if she continues to play, which I at a high level, which I hope she does.
Yeah, and Lydia actually knew her future. I remember at the U.S. Open when it was out in Southampton, right next door to National and Shinnecock. Lydia Ko finished her round, and they were discussing how to get her up to the clubhouse. And I was a little disappointed. She was only 14. She said, "I want to go away where I won't have to sign any autographs." And I stopped her for a minute. I said, "Lydia, there's going to come a day when you're going to be dying to sign autographs." And lo and behold, she turned into a delightful player, very talented player, and a very nice person. A great addition to the World Golf Hall of Fame.
Yeah, under the LPGA criteria, that gets her in. So great, just a great 2 weeks, Bob. Looking forward to Riviera Country Club outside of Los Angeles for the 2028 competition golf in the Olympics. Okay, we got the U.S. Amateur this week, Bob, at Hazeltine National outside of Minneapolis. And I don't know about you, but I wouldn't want to be playing Luke Clanton in match play, which begins tomorrow. Clanton, Florida State player, has already he's gotten through the first two rounds of qualifying. And if he's not the prohibitive favorite, there's something wrong. He's tied Jack Nicklaus now. He's the only amateur since 1961 to finish in the top 10 in PGA Tour events three times. He led with about, or tied for the lead with, what, seven or eight holes to go at the Wyndham Championship, played 39 holes on Sunday, and he finished fifth. This guy, hope he comes back and plays more collegiate golf, but Bob, he certainly has proven he can play at the highest levels. He may, you know, do what Nick Dunlap did after he won earlier this year and turned professional. Wouldn't surprise me at all.
No, I agree with you there, Kelly. It's almost crazy for him not to turn professional. He's proven that he's got what it takes, and just a major accomplishment. Just even saying the words, you know, yeah, from the tour back to the U.S. Amateur, sounds like it was typed backwards for me by our wonderful executive producer, Janice Self. And I know she doesn't make mistakes like that.
No.
So it is true. From the tour back to the U.S. Amateur, good luck, Luke Clanton. You got a hell of a reputation to put up with. I'll guarantee you that.
Before we get to Padraig Harrington, Bob, Tanglewood Golf Club in Winston-Salem is special to me. It's where the PGA Championship was played in 1974. Lee Trevino won it. He actually gave me the hat that he wore is on the cover of Sports Illustrated the following week. Dan Jenkins wrote a great piece. Great buddy of mine, guy I grew up playing golf with as a kid. Gregor Howard lived right up the street from me. My boy Gregor made his third career hole-in-one August the 5th at Tanglewood, where he's a member, on number 16, 213 yards with a three hybrid. Way to go, Gregor Howard. The man can play. I wish I could keep up with him. I think he's going to now have to give me even more shots, Bob, per nine than I was getting before.
He's been giving you too many shots for years, but congratulations on that hole in one. Takes a lot of courage to make a hole in one. Also takes a lot of courage to give a hat to Kelly Elbin, because pretty good chance the hat's going to be too small.
Because the head's too big. I got it. Padraig Harrington, Bob, you've known him a long time, and he's the classiest of individuals. If you listen, if anybody gets a chance to listen to the speech he gave in June when he was inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame, it says it all. Great player, but Bob, as you like to say, easily an even greater person.
No, absolutely, and a greater family man. The speech his son gave was absolutely magnificent. I know Padraig was very proud of that. I would say just about everybody that gets into the Hall of Fame is deserving of the honor. There's no doubt in anybody's mind that knows anything about golf that Padraig Harrington deserves to be in there. And he is as classy on the golf course as he is off the golf course.
And you all will hear from Padraig Harrington right after this from our partners, William and Harry, Titleist, and the South Florida PGA Golf Pass. Our friends at William and Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William and Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com.
Titleist is the number one ball in golf. Yes, being number one is a number, and more players trust the Pro V1 or Pro V1X than all other golf balls combined. But being number one is more than a number. It's a mindset. It's a relentless mission to design and manufacture the best performing golf balls in the game, so you can chase whatever your number one is. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Celebrating its 30th year, the South Florida PGA Golf Pass offers the ultimate summer golf experience with special access to more than 100 private, semi-private, and public golf facilities. From May 1st through October 31st, Golf Pass members can enjoy special low rates, exclusive member-only outings, special offers, and more. For just $60, you can purchase the South Florida PGA Golf Pass and instantly gain access to all these great benefits through the member-only app. It's simple. Pay, download, play. Visit sfpgagolf.com/golfpass for more information. That's sfpgagolf.com/golfpass. Bob, on June 10th, 2024, in Pinehurst, North Carolina, our special guest today officially was enshrined in the World Golf Hall of Fame, and for good reason. He won three major championships. He's accumulated 40 professional victories worldwide. He was a member of six consecutive European Ryder Cup teams, and he spent more than 300 weeks in the top 10 of the world rankings. And when he isn't playing competitively today, he's passing along invaluable golf lessons through his YouTube show, Paddy's Golf Tips. What a thrill to welcome Padraig Harrington to Musings on Golf. Padraig, thanks so much for joining us. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. It's good to be on your show. Interesting to see what we're going to cover. Musings on Golf gives it quite a broad topic, so we can get onto here.
Absolutely.
What was it like when you got the call that you had been elected to the World Golf Hall of Fame? What were your feelings the night of the enshrinement when your son Paddy presented you? And let me just add one thing. I think the job that Paddy did, your son, had to be the proudest moment of your life. I mean, he was fantastic. He was from the brain. He was from the heart. He was from the soul. And when sons have that amount of love for their father, I mean, it's simply incredible.
Yeah, there's two parts to that. Being brought up in Ireland, we don't have Hall of Fames in Ireland. So wouldn't have been a thing growing up. But once you get out on tour and you start winning events, and then you're looking at your peers and you're going, I want to be like that guy. And you start winning, trying to win majors. Then you win a major, you play the Ryder Cups. All of a sudden, your peers at that stage are potentially Hall of Fame, are Hall of Fame guys, and you want to be one of them. So, and then you move on to the Champions Tour, and it becomes it's a big focal point in the Champions Tour, who's in the Hall of Fame, but the logo's on the board, they announce you. So I'm out there and I'm looking at my peers. I'm going, I want to be in that group. And I knew, I'd been eligible for the, since you're 45, and Tiger went in the first year I was eligible. And, they talked to me about it and said, yeah, you had the votes, but obviously it wasn't your time. So that's all very well and good, but I wasn't in. So all of a sudden I'm waiting on this next time, and COVID comes along, and, I'm sitting there, I want to enjoy this Hall of Fame. I want to be, I'm waiting for it. So when it was confirmed, it was relief. There's no doubt about it. There was a sense of relief that, look, it's going to be done. It's going to happen. I'm in there. They can't take it away from me once you're in there. It was a big sense of relief to be included in that number, to be out with players I watched on TV, players I admire, players I looked up to. I'm now part of that group. And on the night, it was quite special when you see the other Hall of Fame players who are there. You go, well, I'm actually one of them. I'll be wearing my Hall of Fame blazer in whatever, every 2 years or 4 years, turning up at that ceremony to see the next guy. But I will say, the second part to your question about my son, going to the actual induction, it felt a bit like a wedding. You're inviting people, you're making sure everybody's ready to go, who's going, you're making a speech, you're preparing your speech. So I would have been reasonably apprehensive all the way up until my son spoke. And once my son spoke, I relaxed completely and really enjoyed the night. Really, really enjoyed it. So it was a big deal. I didn't realize the pressure was, you worry about other people rather than yourself. So it was him getting up and speaking. I hadn't heard his speech before he spoke. So that was nice. It felt fresh. It was fresh to me. It was new to me. What was interesting about him speaking, which I'm really proud about, is he did a great job. But when it came about that I was going to be in the Hall of Fame and I needed somebody to speak, it wasn't a question of him volunteering. It wasn't a question of him asking. He took it on his responsibility to do it. As the oldest son, it was his job to do this. That's the way he looked at it. He was going to present it purely because that's what he should do. That was his responsibility. So that was a nice side to it as well, that he really, really took it upon himself that this is his job in life, is to go and do things like this, and he did a great job of it. So I was very proud of him. I was really enjoyed it and was very excited, and it really did help me enjoy the overall night and the induction.
How special was it, Patrick, that your dad was a great athlete also? So your son is giving this unbelievable speech. You're getting this unbelievable reward. And you have the knowledge that your dad was quite an athlete.
Yeah, my dad was a very successful Gaelic footballer. So that'd be the number one sport in Ireland. Participation-wise, he would have played at the very highest level. He lost two finals in 56 and 57. Very strange. He was a tough competitor on the golf on the pitch, but I never saw it in his personality. His interactions with me, he was never living his sporting life through my golf. From the stories I hear back, the man I knew was a much softer, gentler man. And sometimes I have to kind of try and equate how he was a tough, opponent on the pitch. Lots of contradictions, some interesting things, but I know he was very competitive, and a lot of my competitive spirit comes from my dad and I suppose my mum. But certainly golfing wise, he retired early. He was a policeman. He retired at 50. And so he spent a lot of time following the golf, but he never put any pressure or stress. If anything, the only pressure or stress I would have got from my dad would have been my etiquette, on the golf course. They would have been very strong on that, So I've never thrown a club in my life. you know, I really avoid losing my temper on the golf course and on all the things that go with trying to just have a good etiquette. My dad would have been around a lot when I was playing golf. So I suppose not that he was watching me, but knowing that he could be watching me made sure that I had the best of etiquette when I was growing up playing golf.
Well, we're honored to be joined by World Golf Hall of Fame member Padraig Harrington here on Musings on Golf. Padraig, having read up on you and knowing you a little bit, you were a very good amateur player, but you also were very serious in terms of studying accounting and looking at that as the possible career. Was that because you did you doubt the ability to be professional? Kind of maybe walk us along what your thought yeah. process was.
I just didn't think I was good enough to be a professional golfer at 18 years of age. So like all 18-year-olds, I didn't know what to do. I wanted to play golf. I wanted to be involved in golf. I certainly loved it. You know, there was no golf scholarships. I didn't look into golf scholarships in the States because at the time they were receiving a very bad, this is now the 80s, they were receiving a very bad press here in Ireland that they weren't worth anything in terms of educational wise. So there was no point in going if you wanted an education or not that if you wanted an if you wanted somebody to take your education seriously, you couldn't go on a golf scholarship. That was so I stayed at home and my brother suggested I did accountancy at night, which was perfect. I studied at night, played golf during the day, and I just kept beating people in amateur golf. I kept winning. I had an 18-month period in Ireland where I played 18 months of stroke play. I was never beaten over 36 holes or more for 18 months. Like, and I just kept, like, I never lost for Ireland playing at the top of the order for 6 years. So I was beating the best guys from Great Britain and Ireland, beating the best guys from Europe. So, you know, eventually I kind of looked at it and says, well, you know, these guys are the best guys turning pro. Maybe I should give it a go. And I still only believed when I was turning pro that I would, you know, if you told me when I was turning pro that I'd have 5 years as a journeyman pro, I'd said, yes, thank you very much. I'll take that and come back and take the country club managerial job. That was my expectations. But like a lot of times with my golf over the years and my very, very best trait in my golf is I'm a great person at just doing it and not really, you know, not questioning it so much. I'm able to beat people in front of me. If I see somebody do something, I'll do it better than. That's my whole, everything I do. If there's somebody a little bit better than me, I want to compete against them. If we were going out and we were having a game of darts or a game of pool, if you were way better than me, I'd have no interest in playing pool with you. If you were way worse than me, I'd have no interest in playing pool with you. If you were slightly better than me, I'd be trying my heart out to beat you. And that's kind of the way of being on the golf course. I'm sure if I looked at the pro, if I look now at the pro who turned pro in 1995, the end of 95, I would have said he wasn't going to make it. But the pro who turned pro in 95 didn't know any different. I was the ultimate pro, you know, that old saying, and they love the saying, you don't hear it as much, you know, dogs that chase cars and pros that put for pars don't last. I was the pro who put for pars, but I didn't judge myself. And this came across, you know, only recently I was talking to a few friends who were, you know, good at golf, should have been better, you know, better, great players. And we're just discussing the game. And there's a group of people out there who believe if you play a hole badly, if you miss the fairway or miss the green or something like that, maybe miss strike a shot, that you're meant to make a bogey at the hole. I didn't know that. I had no concept of what you deserved. You deserved the score you got. That was it. So if I made a par at the hole and I hit two terrible shots or three terrible shots and made par, I didn't judge myself as being lucky I made a par. That was it. Whereas there's a lot of people think that, you know, if they've missed the green and they chip it up to 8 feet and they miss or 10 feet, they're angry, but that's what they think they deserve. I didn't have that holding me back. And regularly at that time, without me knowing it, I would hit, you know, especially on the course I grew up on was very tricky. I'd happily hit 9 greens in regulation and 67, 68. You know, whereas you still see, and even I get drawn into this later on in my career, you still see, you know, the guys who want to come in and champion. I shot 74, I hit 16 greens in regulation, you know, I hit 34 putts. And you're going, or 30, whatever, that would be 32 putts or something like, you know, as in, so you're basically, you're kind of, people love that stuff. I didn't know any different. Just what's the lowest score I could make from this position? And just, I'm very good at playing the next shot. Very, very good at, you know, what I don't really get angry about shots, but I'm really good at being into the next shot and not carrying over the, you know, the disappointment of hitting a bad shot.
Well, it's often been said, a bad memory, one of the most valuable assets you could have as a professional golfer. Now, you've won 8 times on the Champions Tour, Padraig. Is there anything that you're doing different on the Champions Tour to win more than you did on the regular tour?
Well, look, there's a couple of things that go with it. Guys who play well on the Champions Tour usually are still competitive, are still trying to be competitive on the main tours late into their 40s. You don't give up playing golf for 10 years and come out in the Champions Tour and find it again. You really have to stick at it. Now, those last couple of years, I would have said maybe about 45 years of age, about 15 years into my, 15 to 20 years into my career, I was burnt out, no doubt about it. But what happens is I kind of found a new lease of life at the end of my full career, where I was playing better, maybe not putting better, but playing better. And then when I got to the Champions Tour, all of a sudden, you kind of, I explain it like this. If I go play a regular tour event and like I've got an 8-footer on Thursday afternoon for par on the 7th hole, if I miss that, I'm starting to think I'm going to miss the cut. Whereas if I got an 8-footer for par in the first round of a Champions Tour event, you know, if I miss this, I'll probably have another birdie chance. There's no cut. I know I'm kind of, I'm pretty much going to have some chance on Sunday afternoon. So I'm not stressed about that 8-footer. So I hole it in the Champions Tour and I probably miss it on the regular tour. So there is an element on the Champions Tour of you're just in, it's a smaller pond. You're more likely to be in contention. You're a bit more relaxed. So good things happen a lot more. And that's similar to when you watch anybody on a great run. You know, when players are having that period, you know, usually it's an 18-month, two-season period where they're playing lights out. Good things are happening. And the reason is they're quite relaxed about it. They're not, their golf swing hasn't changed. They're no different a person. But, you know, every time they make a bogey, they seem to make a birdie to follow up. You know, they're in contention a lot. And it just snowballs for a period of time. And that's kind of like what it's like on the Champions Tour at the moment, that you're just, I know I'm going to have a great chance of being presented with a chance of winning on Sunday. And that, you know, that doesn't mean I could be 5 back with 9 to play. I could be tied in around the lead. I could be ahead. But I'm going to be playing Sunday afternoon. Whereas you stuck me out in a PGA Tour event, it's a lot of hard work and I'm always on edge. I'm always don't want to make a mistake because I don't feel like I can take any punches with the regular guys, but on the Champions Tour, I can feel I can take a few hits and still survive.
You know, you talked about that 18-month stretch as an amateur. You had an unbelievable 13-month stretch as a professional where you won all 3 of your major championships, from the Open Championship in 07 through to the PGA Championship at Oakland Hills in 08. Okay, you mentioned about relaxation and so forth, but the world was going so well for you over that ridiculous stretch of 5 events?
Well, it really started for me in 2006. So I had a plan going into my majors, how I would peak for those major tournaments. And I started putting that in place in 2006. And winged foot, I had 3 pars to win at winged foot. Even had a putt in the last to get in the playoff. And I played the holes. I hit the 3 fairways. Like, come on. You've done the work at a US Open. You've hit the 3 fairways. Like, I'm hitting 5-iron, 9-iron, and 9-iron into the 3 holes. And I made 3 bogeys. But I was in the zone on that Sunday. So my plan worked. How to get myself into the zone. I should be trying to get in on Thursday, but by Sunday, I was in the zone. And that gave me tremendous confidence going into 2007, 2008, that I had a process that got me into the zone where I felt if I did that for the four majors, I'd probably play well in three and compete in two. And if I competed in two each year, I felt I'd win one. Now, as it turned out, I won three. But, you know, when you relax and you have a process and you believe that this is good enough. So 2006 was the first time I teed up in a major, played the tournament, and felt I could have won that tournament without anybody else's help. I didn't need to get lucky. Now, I say I didn't need to get lucky. Of course you get lucky when you win tournaments. You don't get bad breaks. You do this, that, and the other. There's lots. But I didn't feel like, up to that, I felt like I had to have some out-of-body experience to win a major. Winged foot was the first time I felt, you know what, if I do my thing, I have a chance of winning. And that's what I applied 2007, 2008, and 2009. You know, the stats will show I played much better in 2009. I played better in 2010. So, you know, a lot of people think I won at that period of time, but I had my best FedEx Cup year in 2009. So, you know, my golf was still good. And then all of a sudden, you know, and maybe I often say this, you know, it could really be 2011 at Congressional might have been what broke me. I remember coming off on the Wednesday afternoon, Adam Scott did an interview. I played a practice round with Adam, and Adam did it in his interview, said, everybody might as well go home. Porter Carrington is winning in his interview, pre the tournament. And I go out and I missed the cut. I found the course very difficult, and Rory McIlroy lapped the field. So Rory goes into this period, and I would have been like, there I am, major contender all the time. And all of a sudden, I'm looking at this kid. I can't compete with him. I feel I can't compete with him. I can't do what he's doing. I couldn't shoot that score. Now, that's the problem with golf. It always feels like that. When you watch somebody playing well, you always think you can't do what they're doing. You know, when you see somebody faded into a back right pin and you're a draw the ball, you go, I can't do that. But that's not the way golf is played, but we get sucked into wanting to do something that somebody else can do. And if we can't do it, we feel inferior. So, yeah, I would say after that, I was chasing, trying to get better, trying to improve. I didn't believe that my stuff was good enough after that period. And that meant I was always trying too hard. So another example of that, and I remember Tiger said, you know, he could win with his B game. Well, if you think you can win with your B game, your A game turns up. If you think you need your A game, your B game turns up. That's just the way golf is. So I was very much in that role of, you know what, I was good enough. I'm good enough. I wasn't looking over my shoulder at anybody else. Okay, I'd have a sneaky look to see what Tiger would shoot, but I wasn't looking over my shoulder. Whereas by 2011, now I'm starting to worry about the field. And you could see this analogy with all the players when they go on the run. They fully believe in themselves. They're not looking around themselves. They're not worried about anybody else. They fully think if they play their best golf, they're going to win. When they lose that little edge, they're thinking, yeah, I need to play my best golf, and I hope he doesn't play his best golf, or I hope he doesn't get the breaks. As in, they're worrying about other people, and that's when you don't play your best. So, you know, that's what changed in my career. And then, you know, but like by 2013, you know, I had my best year tee to green in 2013, and I ended up, you know, like we talked earlier, I was feeling under so much pressure and strain that I was on a limit that I ended up with the putting yips. So, you know, the game is far more mental than we ever want to let believe. We always think we can physically overcome any mental insecurities or issues by having a great golf swing. But the reality is, there's no golf swing that will overcome a bad mental thought. And there's plenty of golf swings that are terrible. But if you stick to what you're thinking right, you know, if you've got your mental game right, you'll be able to work with it and be a great player.
Fascinating stuff. Bob, I know you wanted to ask Padraig about golf in the Olympics.
It was absolutely incredible what we witnessed at the Olympics. What did you think of the whole thing, including, you know, the miraculous victory by Scottie Scheffler, and in your eyes, how good is Scottie Scheffler?
Right, two things to that. There's a little bit of smugness about me when it comes to golf in the Olympics, because I spoke at the Congress back in 2000 and It was about 2011, 2012 to get golf into the Olympics, and everybody said, no, we don't want golf in the Olympics. We won't. You know, there were so many dissenters, and now after three Olympics only, people are starting to see the merit of it, see the joy of it. It looks like it was a very timely win by Scotty for the game of golf, to have the world number one win the Olympics the way he won. It does add to the lure of it. But we're now seeing, you know, you see with Djokovic and the tennis, it's a big deal for us sports people to compete in the Olympics and include ourselves with the other Olympic athletes, to be part of that, to feel like we're you know, golfers, it is a game, but when we play in the Olympics, we get to feel like we're elite athletes and sportsmen. So it's a big deal that we're in the Olympics. It's big for golf in all the countries around the world that aren't golf centric. So for example, I can go to countries, you know, like Turkey. You can go play golf in Turkey and they will announce me in, if I'm doing something, they'll announce me as an Olympic athlete and a three-time major winner. As in the Olympic bit has more, it's not that it has more credibility to them because that's what they know. So it is a huge deal for golf. People who are critical of golf in the Olympics are only looking at what difference does it make to America. It doesn't. It makes a difference in all those countries that if you're looking for financial support from government, you must be an Olympic sport. So there's so many countries around the world that the federations, golf federations, gain by golf being in Olympics. And it's great to see that the players are getting on board saying that it's the, you know, you saw both John Rahm and Rory say it's in the top two events in golf for them. Obviously, that's at the moment a little bit of hyperbole in it, but it's come a long way in 12 years and will continue to strive golf in the Olympics. As regards Scotty Scheffler, he's just a phenomenal player. It is relentless. You know, I think players, he's a nice guy. So sometimes, you know, a bad boy image would get a little, you know, people would make more of him as a star if he had that a little bit. You know, he has got some funny footwork. So people are not going to be copying his footwork. But the way he moves that club, the way he handles pressure, the way he is, you know, week in, week out, you know, it's hard to win back-to-back weeks. And he continues to deliver week after week. You know, even for a player like him, surely when he was five shots back with six holes to go, he's got to think he's out of it. But no, he's still trying. He's still in there. And he delivered. Fabulous for the game of golf. Fabulous for the Olympics. But he's some player, Scotty. And, you know, I suppose, like, before the Olympics, you might have been thinking Xander for player of the year, maybe. Wouldn't that be, like, Scotty's won so much and you're still thinking Xander. Now, all of a sudden, with the Olympics, it's the two of them are phenomenal at the moment. And, you know, probably good for each of them that they'll push each other along.
We're in the final holes of our time with the great Padraic Harrington here on Musings on Golf. Padraic, two questions to close this out, please. Number one has to do with Paddy's golf tips, and you've become a YouTube sensation. And it's fantastic that you've chosen that medium and to offer instruction. I was particularly really touched. There was I don't know if it was an actual Paddy's golf tip or just an interview that you did where you talked about kids and getting them on the golf course and then the time spent with them afterward, whether having a Coke, having an ice cream. Could you maybe elaborate a little bit on the experience for kids, not just for them in the game as kids, but because it's a lifetime sport?
Yeah, there's a couple of things to this. One, you know, if a kid takes up golf at 10, there's a good chance he'd been playing it for 90 years. You know, at 100 years of age, in 90 years' time, there's a chance that, you know, young people will still be active at that age. So it's a long time. And I think parents, we get drawn into when it comes to sport, that we want our kids good tomorrow. We want to help them get as good as we can. Now, the interesting thing is, we think that being good will make them love the sport straight away. That's not the case. The kids will figure it out themselves, and kids have loads of time. They're not in a hurry. They don't need to be in a hurry. So we don't need to rush in. Even if we see them doing something wrong, we don't need to rush in and help them, because even with the best of intentions, most kids, if you give them advice, feel like it's criticism. That's just the way it is. So yeah, if you really need to get something changed, you know, get the uncle that they look up to, somebody like that, or get the friend that they look up to tell them. Don't you go tell them, because they want to do so well for you that they feel like you're criticizing. So leave them alone. Bring them to the golf course where you're not stressed, okay? Because they pick up on your stress. If you go to the fancy country club and you're worried about them, you know, getting in the way or doing something, they'll pick up on that. They won't enjoy that experience. Bring them where they're relaxed. When they're enjoying themselves, we always think, oh, right, this is going well. And we let them stay too long and they get tired. And they'll remember being tired. It's like going to the gym. If you go to the gym and you leave within 40 minutes, you'll want to go back to the gym tomorrow. If you stay for an hour and a half, you'll remember tomorrow when you have time to go to the gym, you remember how tired you were yesterday, and you won't want to go the next day. You'll certainly, that's why people join in the 1st of January and give up by the 31st of January, because they've gone too many times and for too long. Nobody can keep that pace up. So when your son or daughter is out there, you know, try and say, right, we've got to go, and make them feel like, we've got to go, but I want to stay. Because then the next day they'll be saying, can you bring me back? Can you bring me back? Rather than waiting till they're tired. So bring them when they're enjoying themselves, say, right, we've got to go. And then the last thing I would do, and this is really for your, you always want to give your kids a good association with what they're doing. So again, that's, you know, you're not being critical and things like that. But when you finish, take 10, 15 minutes to sit down somewhere. And as I say, go to the clubhouse and have a Coke. Go have an ice cream on the way home, whatever it is. The kids will enjoy that and will associate two things with that for the rest of their life. They'll associate, when I play golf, it's fun. And they'll also associate the 10, 15 minutes of me time with their mother or father as a way, every time they play golf for the rest of their life, they'll remember the time they spent with their parents, that good feeling. So golf to them would be, oh, that was the time I spent with my father or mother. That was the time I enjoyed. That was the best part of my childhood. So they'll love golf for the rest of their life doing that. So again, everybody can come up with a few of these tips. But the main thing is, especially if you're just an average golfer, do not try and help your kid play golf. You don't know enough. You really don't know enough. Telling him to keep his head down or swing slowly ain't going to help him. He'll figure it out. And, you know, let the club pro give the lessons and do whatever. The kids will figure it out from their friends. They'll have fun doing it. And just don't, you know, don't get too involved.
It's just wonderful stuff. Patrick, final question from me. It's one that we ask all of our guests, and we've had varying answers on this, and has to do with a dream foursome. If you could round out and have three players play with you, whether they're living or deceased, who would those three be, and where would you play that round of golf?
Okay, well, I would go straight to my family, obviously, if it's just that. And I'd go, obviously, my dad's passed away, so he'd be top of the list. I have four brothers, so there might be a bit of a bun fight for that last two spots. But I think it's more interesting if I pick three professional golfers. Yeah. And I would go to the past, just because I you know, clearly I'd like to, you know, I played in tournaments where Jack Nicklaus, Arnold Palmer played. So I've not competed against them, but played in them. So I'd go further back. I'd probably pick guys I haven't seen. So it would be Sam Snead, Hogan, and probably Bobby Jones. At this moment, I just want to see them on the golf course and see is there how much truth to the myth there would be with these guys. I'm sure there's a lot of truth to it, but I want to see it firsthand. So that would probably be my professional four ball. And golf course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it once or every day? See, this is the thing. I love a golf course that's different every day. That's to
one
me,
time.
That's
the, this, this yeah. would be one round of golf.
I would probably pick Royal Portrush in Ireland. Yeah, I've had some great memories. I love the golf course. There's some risk reward on the golf course. I don't like a golf course that just straightforward beats you up all the time. So probably Royal Portrush. And I've had good times on it, and it's a fun golf course. There's lots of drama. You can be playing great and get really messed up, and you can make some birdies. So yeah, that would be the one. Like the tournament courses, you know, if you want to US, like there's no better place to play a tournament than Augusta. I'm going to give you one that I'm going to be controversial and go with the two LA clubs for me, Riviera and LA Country Club. Hmm. And they always want to know who's better than each other. They're both great. Leave it at that.
Perfect words. They're both great. And that's what we mean when we're talking about Padraig Harrington. I uncovered what I think is your edge during this interview. I fully realize that a lot of players try two things. They want to be great and they want to be nice. For some, it's a lot of work to be nice. For Padraig Harrington, it's in his heart, it's in his soul, and it's in his family, and it's in the way he conducts himself with other people. Padraig, we've done many of these, but never have we had a guest that spoke from the heart like you did. We thank you, thank you, thank you. Let's get a lot more wins on that Champions Tour.
We're trying. I think, by the way, Bob, that comes from being the youngest of five boys. You're always the peacemaker in that situation.
Well, you do it well. Thanks, Padraig.
Thank you. Thanks, Bob.
Our friends at William & Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William & Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com. Bob, so many terrific things that Padraig had to say. I love that last story having to do with, you know, getting kids on the golf course, the memories that you might spend with them, having a Coke or an ice cream afterward. The love of the game, Bob, that guy has the love of the game, and the way he's been able to pass it along through his videos and through that message to, I think, anybody who can relate to trying to get kids involved in the game.
Yeah, very well said, Kel. You know, I think of Padraig Harrington, I think of heart, and I think of soul, and I think of golfer. Those three words describe Padraig Harrington to me to a T. A perfect gentleman on the golf course, a perfect gentleman off the golf course, and one hell of a talent. The World Golf Hall of Fame is no doubt a little better place now that they have a new resident by the name of Padraig Harrington.
Isn't that the truth? We thank Padraig Harrington for joining us here. Next week, the great golf instructor Jim McLean will be our guest. For Bob Bupka, well, we covered a lot today, Bob. Kelly Elbin, thanking you for joining us. Musings on Golf.